This is the Plant on the Line program here at thecommentary.ca. 65 Roses, a sister's memoir, was designated a Book of the Year in the Globe and Mail's Top 100 listing last year. It tells the story of Pamela Summerhays, who at the age of 4 is diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. The author, Pam's sister Heather Summerhays Carew, discusses her family's unfortunate but hopeful story. It's evocative and well-written, deeply personal and affecting. Published by MacArthur & Company, a portion of the proceeds from the sales of this book will be donated to the Canadian Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. A former professional actress and dancer, the author lives in Manhattan with her husband, the noted actor Len Carew. She spoke with me from Cornwall, Ontario.
Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Heather Summerhays Carew. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
For people that are unfamiliar, perhaps, with what cystic fibrosis is, what is it? It's a disease?
It's the most common life-threatening disease of children and young adults. It's carried by both parents. Each of them have a recessive gene. It affects the respiratory and digestive systems. So in very plain English, a CF person would have pneumonia constantly and always be fighting that lung infection. And also they would not get the proper value from their food, so they'd be in a state of starvation virtually. And the treatment for the disease is to take many, many antibiotics to fight the lung infection, to take many, many enzymes to help digest the food and get the value of it. A lot of physical therapy to clear the lungs, and inhalation therapy, and once in a while a hospitalization for what the kids might call a tune-up when they have to go in for IV antibiotics. It's a lifetime struggle.
You're diagnosed at an early age, like your sister was, correct?
Hopefully. Many doctors still miss the signs. I just recently met a woman who is 35. She had a baby just a couple of years ago. Her daughter was diagnosed at 3 months with cystic fibrosis. They decided to sweat test the rest of the family, which is the test that they give, and found that the mother also had cystic fibrosis and had never known it.
So what are the symptoms then? Like you're saying she's 35. She just didn't know?
She had been sick all her life. In various ways, she got, 9 or 10 colds a winter, and they always went into her chest. They just told her she had asthma, or they told her she had a weak chest. She had always had digestive problems. They thought she had Crohn's disease. In early years, the disease used to be called the Great Masquerader, because some of the symptoms mimic symptoms of other illnesses. And if you really don't know what you're looking for, or you don't know if there has been a history of CF in your family, some doctors still find it difficult to diagnose.
And the survival rate is what? Is it?
Well, it's increased enormously. The average life expectancy now is 37 years. And we just discovered in the last few months through statistics that for the first time we have 50% of our cystic patients are adults now, which is a dream come true for those people who started the foundation nearly 50 years ago. In those days, in the 1950s, when the foundation first began, many diagnoses took place at autopsy in infancy. So in the last 40 years, the foundation has brought research a tremendous way. It's really quite spectacular.
We'll talk about the founding of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation in Canada, and your parents were instrumental in that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in CF and just sort of setting the scene before we talk to... Well, we'll talk about your sister then. She exhibited what symptoms at age 4?
She had had pneumonia several times. By the time she was 4 years old, she had exhibited failure to thrive. So in other words, she was eating voraciously but not gaining any weight. And the classic symptom is that their skin tastes very salty. When you kiss them, there's a very salty taste. There's an old German saying that says, the child who tastes salty will soon die. So this goes back centuries before they knew what the name of the disease was and what it did.
Had other people in your family, I know that your sister Pam, she had it, and your brother as well.
Mm-hmm.
Had anyone else in the family had it before Pam did?
Not that we were aware of, because Pam was diagnosed in 1958, and the disease had only been isolated as a disease in 1948, 10 years before. Dr. Dorothy Anderson from Children's Hospital in New York, she was a pathologist, and she ran a big study on babies who had died of respiratory disease and discovered cystic fibrosis. Also, you know, the gene, because it's recessive, it can skip many generations. So it's important for people to know that there's a million carriers of this gene in Canada and 10 million carriers of the gene in the United States. One out of every 25 people carries the gene and probably doesn't know it. So it's conceivable that if you don't have a CF child in your family now, your offspring or their offspring could be born with cystic fibrosis.
You noted earlier that life expectancy has increased to 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
When your sister was first diagnosed, what was the outlook then?
Well, my parents were told by the doctors 6 months, maybe 6 years, if they looked after her very well and watched her closely. She lived till she was 26, largely because of the research at the Canadian Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, but also her own will, and I think family support. She gave a lot of credit to family support and love, and indeed we did organize around her and eventually my youngest brother as a family, and our life became largely about fighting for their life.
The title of the book is 65 Roses, because she was 4 years old, she couldn't pronounce cystic fibrosis. Is that
yeah,
right?
A lot of the kids say, I have 65 roses when they're little.
Now, how did she knew, I guess your parents told her right then and there that she was going to die?
Well, my parents, you know, they had a choice whether to keep things from us or whether to be straight out, and they just felt it would be better to tell us in any way we could understand and let us in on what was going on to avoid bigger problems down the road. And I think they were absolutely right to do that. So my mom gathered us up on our little pink chenille bedspreads about 2 weeks after she was diagnosed and told us that Pam had something called cystic fibrosis and that some children died of this disease and that dying meant that we leave home where we live with our family and go to another home where we live with God, and that everybody goes to this home at some point. Everybody dies. But they were sure that Pam wouldn't die for a long time, and they would work very hard to make her feel better, and they would never give up. And that really became our family motto, that we were never going to give up fighting for Pam. And eventually it became the motto for my own life, because everybody's life is worth fighting for, not just somebody who's sick.
Right. How did she deal with it, though? I mean, did she... I don't know how to ask this question. I guess if you know you're going to die, do you live differently? And I guess by the same token, you all sort of live differently.
Well, I think she did live differently, even as a child. But she didn't dwell on it. I think I was the person who dwelt more on her imminent death than she did, or on the terminal aspects of it. She just decided if that was going to be her destiny, to have a short life, she was just going to get out there and live it up as best as she could, and did so in a very feisty, joyful, fun-loving, and spiritual way. Part of that was her nature, but part of that, I believe, came to her from dealing with the obstacles that she had to deal with and the limitations in her life, and how she observed other children living with the disease, and also the kind of support she got from our family, from the community, from the clergy, from the nurses and the medical team. And she just took all that and really made something beautiful out of it. The way I put it in the book was that she took sort of the broken pieces of her life as one would take broken glass, and made a mosaic out of it.
She seems to me, reading this book, wiser than even when she was a kid, wiser than her age was.
Yes, well, I think that dealing with an illness like that does that, and I've noticed that in many young children who have a disability, particularly a life-threatening one. And we tend to think, oh, well, kids don't know or kids don't understand, and we try to protect children from certain knowledge about their illness or their death, but I think kids are braver and know more than we give them credit for. Quite often, children are trying to protect the adults from the information rather than the other way around. And, you know, when you're in a ward at a hospital, when you're 8, 9, 10 years old, and you're in a ward with other dying children, initially they didn't have a CF ward at the Hospital for Sick Children, so she was put in with a lot of children who had pediatric cancer. And you are witnessing the deaths of children your own age, I think that wises you up pretty fast to what's going on around you. And I would venture to say that children have the same choices adults do when they face an obstacle or a limitation or a tragedy, and that is to either crawl under a rock or decide to grow toward the light. So that's one of the things, actually, being Pam's sister, that I've learned. It was something she taught me, that the only power any of us really have in our lives is the power to choose our response to our given situation. And we always have a choice of how we're going to respond, to be forgiving or bitter, to be loving or hateful, to be joyful or full of despair. That's always our choice. She learned that very young and passed that on to me.
It's a great line in the book, choose our joy in each moment.
Yes.
And I guess that's one of the great lessons in this book that I came across, came from reading it. Talk to me about, you were accepted into the National Ballet School.
Yes.
How old were you?
Yeah, I was 9. The first year I went to ballet school, I was 9. I went for the summer. Then I went back the following summer when I was 10, and they accepted me into the winter school. And so I could have gone away to boarding school at National Ballet and been a ballerina, but I thought that Pam was probably going to die very young, and I couldn't stand the thought of her dying while I was away from home or from missing her life, such as it was, from being away. And I was also extremely guilty about having my dreams come true when I felt that hers would not. So I gave it up and came home. And she was very upset with me because she couldn't abide anybody who gave up easy, and she thought that's what I had done. Then when she realized why I had really given it up, I think it really, unbeknownst to me for a long time, it placed a real burden on her, because in a sense I had given up on my own life because of her, and that really wasn't a fair burden to have put on her, but it complicated our relationship, and it also complicated our relationship that when she was initially diagnosed when I was 6, I promised to die with her. I didn't feel it was fair that God was going to make her die or that she should die alone. And of course, when you're 6, you're so omnipotent. You think you can do or change anything. So I thought that I would be able to die with her. And I think when she did pass away when she was 26, and she died at home, and I was holding her hand as she died. A few minutes later, I really found it remarkable that I was still standing there. Even though I knew intellectually I couldn't just drop dead, but I sort of felt, I guess, in my 6-year-old heart that maybe I would. And I guess also, you know, she loved me and knew me, I think, better than I loved and knew myself. And one of my tasks in recovering from her loss was to learn how to see myself compassionately and to love myself the way she had loved me. And certainly writing this book, as she instructed me to do, has helped me to do that.
It's a great, it's a poignant or powerful moment in the book where she tells you to write this book.
Yes.
When was that?
That was the last conversation we had. She was literally on her deathbed, the final weekend of her life. So she said that to me about 24 hours before she died. I felt like I was getting divine instruction, actually, that it wasn't even her telling me, that it was a force that was speaking through her to me, giving me direction in my life. That's because she was, at that point, fighting so hard just to breathe, never mind talk. And she was holding onto my hand fiercely and really staring me right in the eye and making me promise that I would tell our story. And she told me that at that time, because I was a young actress, that she didn't think I was a bad actress, but that I wasn't really meant to stay in the theater, that I was meant to write and that I was meant to teach. And this is the path that would lead me to becoming the person I was meant to become and meeting the people I was meant to meet. And darned if she hasn't been right.
It took a while, though, for the book to make it cover to cover.
I wrote for 20 years. I did draft after draft after draft. A writer has to be able to stand outside the story, particularly if you're writing memoir, and it's a very emotional one. And how you get perspective, or how I got perspective, was just writing draft after draft. Because every draft I wrote had a kind of agenda. I had a draft that was my Reader's Digest draft, which is just to get the story down on paper. I had another agenda to work out my grief. I had another agenda to work out my anger. And nobody wanted to read that draft, not even me, when I was done. But it's like when I was an actor, when you're in rehearsal, you try the scenes a lot of different ways. You go down a few blind alleys, but you always find a little nugget down that blind alley that you can bring back that stays with your performance. And I found writing very much the same way, that many stories didn't get into the book, but by writing them, I found a nugget that I could bring into the book, or found a truth by which I could illuminate another story that did go into the book. My husband was the one who gave me the best advice when I started out. He said, just write everything. And also the first few years that I was writing, I was having an argument with myself about whether becoming a writer meant that I was giving up acting, and did that make me a failure as an actor. And that was a very long and intense conversation. So eventually, I did go on sabbatical from acting. I decided if I was going to write this book, because I wanted to write something really literate. I wanted the book to be like a novel, and I wanted it to read like a lot of the books I love to read. So in order to learn to write at a higher level, I had to take a few years and really learn how to write. I did that by attending workshops, by writing and writing and writing, by reading a lot of memoir to see how other people were doing it. So I devoted myself to my writing with the same kind of passion I had devoted myself to acting.
This story about the whitewater rafting trip, had you met your husband, Len, yet? Or?
I had just met him, and he offered to buy me a drink if I survived the whitewater rafting trip. We had met, and we were sitting in a bar, and he'd had a wonderful romance with Lauren Bacall, and I knew of this, so I guess I was sort of trying to be a bit Bacallish at the time. And I had this long, curly hair, and I had a drink in front of me, and I had a cigarette, and I was puffing and drinking and flipping my hair, and he said, tell me about yourself. And I said, you want to know about me? Of course, I had a chip on my shoulder about this big. And I said, well, my sister died a year ago, and 6 months ago, my first marriage ended, and next week I'm leaving for Oregon on an all-woman whitewater rafting trip, and I don't swim. I think I was kind of throwing down the gauntlet, you know. And he just smiled, and he says, well, if you survive, come back, and I'll buy you a drink. And I did, and he did, and the rest is history. We've now been married 20 years. And
he was quite supportive of you writing this book.
I couldn't have done it without him.
What about the rest of your family, your parents, your brothers?
My family was very supportive of writing the book, but I think that's because they didn't really know what I was writing. And I don't know if they really imagined it would ever come to fruition. I also had the great support of the International Women's Writing Guild, and I really owe my life as a writer to them more than anybody, and the women at that guild, who the workshop leaders at the Skidmore Summer Conference, which I have attended for 23 years. It's just an incredible place where women can be empowered by the written word, and they believe very much in women telling their own stories. So that really helped. Then I think what helped the very last draft of the book, when I gave the last draft of the book, or what I thought was the last draft, to my parents, they read it. My mom sat me down on a sunny day on the porch behind their house. We're having a cup of tea, and she said, "Well, we're very proud of this effort. You've written a very good story. We don't agree with everything in it, but we're very proud of you at any rate. And, however, we feel that you're holding something back, maybe on account of how your dad and I are going to feel." And she said, "If there's one thing I've learned in my life, you have to stand in your own truth. And I'm not going to stand in the way of you speaking from your truth." So she said, "I want you to go back and give it another go. And really let it out. And don't worry about how your father and I are going to feel. We will deal with it." I thought it took tremendous courage for her to say that to me, to give me that permission, because she was right. I had been holding back. And it was very liberating for me as a woman, as a daughter, and particularly as a writer. And so this was the draft that really came out. I went back. It took me another year and a half.
What did your brothers think?
Well, my youngest brother, Jeff, who has CF, and he's 45, he's read it twice, and he just loves it. And my other brother, Greg, who is my other well sibling, married with four boys, he has told me that he's not going to read it, although I know his wife has read it and has read parts of it to him. And I just think that he's just at a place where he's not ready to go back over all that. Everybody in the family, you know, has different memories or different context of their memories of what happened. So this is my truth. It's not necessarily Greg's truth or what Greg remembers. He's also 5 years younger than me. So with that, even that 5-year difference, he remembers things differently, or he's not party to information that I had. So he feels very differently about it, and I think he'll come around and probably read it quietly and secretly one of these days. I mean, he's come to appearances that I've made, and so he's heard me read sections of the book, and he's written me and told me that he's very, very proud of my writing it. But for him to read it, I guess, it would stir up a lot of his own memories and his own feelings, aside from anything I've written, because what I have written is a memoir. It's a window into that life. It's not the whole life. And he's not willing to stir those memories up for himself, and that's his choice, and I respect it. I don't take anything personal by it.
And you remain very active with the Canadian Cystic Fibrosis Foundation even to date, correct?
Well, I certainly am through the book these days, because I'm speaking to chapters and speaking in other venues and raising awareness of cystic fibrosis. But I think what I really want readers to know is that it's not just a book about cystic fibrosis, about a disease. It's about fighting for your life, whoever you are and whatever your dreams are, and not giving up. And for me, it's also about what I call the four pillars of Pam's legacy, which I think anyone can use in their life, which is one, that you can't control your life by being afraid of it. And so often when we're making our decisions, we make them out of fear. Oh, what if I do that? What's going to happen? You know, that makes our lives smaller. And I think we're here to really live large, to enjoy this world and the people in it and our loved ones as much as we possibly can, and to express our talents and our gifts as fully as we can. And fear holds us back. Another thing was what I mentioned, that Pam taught me the only power we have in our life is our power to choose, our reaction to things, and the responsibility for each one of us to choose our joy in every moment. I'm not talking about happiness or contentment. I think that joy is really a choice. And I know that in the aftermath of Pam's death and the end of my first marriage, when you could have just about wiped the floor with me, part of my recovery was based on my ability to get up every morning and just find one little thing in the day that would bring me joy. And I knew that if Pam could have done that through her years of pain and suffering, that I could do that too. And the other thing is to understand the difference between surrender and giving up, and not to give up, ever. I think giving up is an act of despair or anger, and surrender is something that can't be accomplished without love. Surrender is a gift that you give to yourself, and surrender is something that happens when you know you have given all you can, all you have to give, and you've received all you can receive, and there just isn't anything more, then you can surrender. Pam's very last words before her last breath were, "I'm not giving up."
Are you working on another book now?
I am. My agent tells me I have a career as a writer.
Certainly.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, that is.
So she's asked me to write a novel, and I'm just at work on the first chapter, and I'm going to spend the summer working on it. I'm very excited because I love writing. I love the process, and I have to say I don't miss acting at all. I probably will never get on a stage again, although you should never say never, but I just really love writing. I love words.
Will you teach?
Well, you know, I think in a way that's happening, because as I'm going out across the country and talking about the book is becoming less and less important in and of itself, and it's becoming the basis for talking to people mostly about how to live a joyful life in spite of illness or loss or tragedy or whatever limitations you have. I'm almost becoming a kind of motivational speaker, so I think there's a lot of teaching going on in what I'm doing.
Heather, thanks for joining us today. Congratulations on writing a well-written and absorbing book. And
thank you.
Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.